Hello, listeners. Hi, I'm Dr. Margaret Vaughn, and welcome to Getting Smarter, a podcast where I get to talk with some of the most transformational thinkers and leaders in the field of education, all in the hopes of getting smarter. Join me in listening and learning. Welcome. Today, we get to talk to the exceptional Dr. Patricia A. Edwards, who was the first African American president of the Literacy Research Association. Dr. Edwards is also the past president of the International Literacy Association, a member of the Reading Hall of Fame, and a National Conference on Research and Language and Literacy Distinguished Scholar, as well as an American Educational Research Association Fellow. Dr. Edwards is the recipient of the Oscar Causey Award and a professor of language and literacy in the Teacher Education Department at Michigan State University. Dr. Edwards is a nationally and internationally recognized expert in parental involvement, homeschool, community partnerships, multicultural literacy and early literacy, and family intergenerational literacy, especially among poor and minority children. Dr. Edwards is also an executive member at large of the American Educational Research Association Special Interest Group Committee and is a member of the 2023 AERA Presidential Program Committee. I am so happy to have the opportunity to talk with Dr. Edwards, who is one of my favorite people in the work.
Dr. Edwards, thank you so much for coming today. How are you?
I am doing really great, and thank you so much for inviting me. One of my former students from Michigan State, she knows you. Her name is Cindy Brock. She works at University of Wyoming.
Oh, I love Cindy.
So I told Cindy that I was going to talk with you. She goes, oh my goodness, I really know her really well. And I said, okay.
Oh, and it's so lovely. Well, I hear you got a special note from one of your, will you share some of that? You got a former note from some people.
I was absolutely thrilled that I got this note on February the 22nd. When I first came to Lansing, I was invited to speak in this rural community. And it was an all-white community and maybe about 18 miles from Lansing. And so the Stump family that owns a electrically milked farm where they milk their cows electronically, that was fun. They invited me out. And so Mrs. Joy Stump wrote me this note just the other day. She goes, our son Daniel, an MSU James Madison graduate, that's the honors, one of the honors colleges here at Michigan State, sent us this wonderful article about your MSU Distinguished Award. You may not remember the Stump Farm in Fowler, where you were our dinner guest before speaking at our PTA-sponsored event in Fowler, Michigan in 1990. Daniel has worked at the Capitol in Lansing for the House of Representatives. Oh my goodness, state representative.
Wow.
He thought we would love and enjoy reading about your many accomplishments through the years. Congratulations and many, many thanks for taking time many years ago for coming out to this rural farming community to share your talent.
Oh,
Mrs. Stump had, she has three boys and a little girl, and the little girl was in kindergarten. It was so funny. She goes, "Ooh, can I take a picture of you?" I said, yes, you can. She said to us, I'm going to have the bestest sharing time because no one will have a black person that they interviewed.
Oh.
We had a good conversation. I said, I think you're right.
Oh, that's so special. It's so thoughtful that they, you know, you have so many layers of impact that you've had on communities and families, and your work is just, it's, I'm going to try, like I told you at the beginning, I'm going to try to play it cool, but I am a super fan. And so
yes.
I am just so inspired, and I can't wait to hear more of your story and your thinking about the work. And so I just can't wait to talk and really listen. I can't wait to listen and learn.
Yes.
So maybe before we get started, and why did you go into the field of education and teaching?
Well, I have a couple of stories. Before Marion Wright Edelman wrote this quote, this is what I was taught as a young girl growing up in the Deep South, Albany. It's Albany, New York, but it's Albany, Georgia, which is about 90 miles from Tallahassee, Florida, 35 miles from Plains, Georgia. I had never heard of Plains until Jimmy Carter became the governor. And it's 192 miles southwest of Atlanta. I was taught that the world had a lot of problems because I grew up during the civil rights movement, and the president of the Albany movement lived right up the street from me, Dr. W.G. Anderson. But I could struggle and change them. And also, growing up in Albany, Georgia, I was told all of my life that teaching was a good career for women, especially Black women. And I was destined to become a teacher. I attended Albany State College, a small Black, historically Black college in the South, and was constantly reminded of how important my role would be as a Black educator in the lives of boys and girls of color. And my professors often informed me that Black students needed to see positive role models in the classroom, especially they needed teachers who understood something about their cultural heritage and background, as well as their learning styles. And in my community, my elementary school principal lived right across the street from me. And then my first grade teacher, who was also my Brownie leader, she lived, I wrote to school with her. And then my music teacher lived in my community. And also my Girl Scout leader lived in my community. And I have to tell you this, I got in a little trouble when I was a small girl because I corrected the reading miscues of my Sunday school teacher. And, I just thought little old ladies that wore glasses couldn't see good. And so as a result, I was going to help her out. So she said, Joshua. And I said, no, she said, Joshua. And I said, no, it's Joshua. And so I got kicked out of her class. But what I realized is that later on, my grandmother told me that Miss Viola could not read that well. I said, well, that's why she should let me help her. But when you are like seven, you corrected somebody that's really old, it didn't go
It
over
doesn't
well.
work.
So I created a Pat Saturday school, where my daddy was a part-time barber, so I had all the boys as they I thought, okay, I'm gonna start a school. So I had a school, and I taught the boys exactly what I had learned during the week. And I would say the song "Where the Boys Are" that was in my backyard. And when they would come, I would say, "Good morning, boys. Welcome to Pat Saturday School. We did not come to your house to go to any school." I said, "Yes, you did." And my daddy would say, "Can you read?" And they would say, "No." It was like these little boys with no teeth. And back in the day, I said, "Well, if you don't come to my school, I'm gonna get my daddy to cut all of your hair off. You'll be a baldy and snag a tooth." So I had a good recruitment strategy, and the boys came to my school.
I love that. I love that. And I loved hearing too about how you read to your dog,
Yes, I
Tony.
read to my dog,
And then
and I read to my friends, and
yeah.
then I could always count on my dolls. They couldn't run away.
I love that. I love that. So how about can you tell me about some highlights, what stands out for your career? You've had such a wonderful, wonderful career, and you are
I
just
would say, in terms of my career, I received the W.K. Kellogg Foundation Fellowship. And those are the cornflake people in Battle Creek, Michigan. I always tell people, please eat your cornflakes. You could focus. When I was teaching at Louisiana Tech, that's where Terry Bradshaw went to school. At the end of student teaching, the students would always tell the faculty that there were two things that we had not done for them. We had not shown them how to work with families and children, and we had not done a lot with discipline. And those are the two things that can break or make a classroom. So when I had the opportunity to apply for this W.K. Kellogg Fellowship, I decided I would focus on the family from a psychological, sociological, cross-cultural, and policy perspective. And at that same time, I had been appointed to the Head Start National Board to look at the incongruence between Head Start and big school, as some people call it. So I volunteered to work at the local Head Start Center right down the street from my house. And I visited with, there were three elementary schools in that town in Ruston, because it was not a big community. And I visited with kindergarten, first and second grade teachers. And I said, look, if you all could tell Head Start parents what to do, what would that be? And let me say this to you, after going to 49 states across the United States and 54 countries, and when I was president of the International Reading Association, teachers all say the same thing, read to your child. And so I volunteered to work at the Head Start Center, and I said, okay, I'm going to ask the question that I know all teachers will ask. And I asked the parents, even though they were not from the state of Missouri, to show me what they would do if a teacher were to ask them to read to their child. And I would say that was one of my biggest studies that I did, looking at the fact that a lot of parents heard what the teacher said, but they didn't know how to implement what the teacher asked. So I wrote a paper in Jo Beth Allen and Jana Mason's book called Risk Takers, Risk Breakers, Risk Makers, Reducing the Risk for Literacy, Young Literacy Learners. And I went out and I showed the teachers the result of parents trying to interpret what they said, what they wanted them to do. And unfortunately, teachers talk about parents and parents talk about teachers. And so it's like the six men of Hindustan. They're all describing an elephant and they're not completely in the right. And so that was probably one of my biggest studies. And then I had the opportunity to move from Louisiana Tech to LSU. And of course, that was my first sort of big research position. And of course, my associate dean's wife was working at a little place called Donaldsonville, Louisiana. And she was a SPUR technical assistant. And SPUR stands for Special Plan for Upgrading Reading. In other words, schools that are not making annual yearly progress. So I got invited to go down to that school. But at the same time, the governor of Louisiana, in his platform speech, was Governor Romer at the time. He said that Louisiana had excellent natural resources. What it needed were better human resources. Well, literacy is a human resource. Well, to be honest with you, I did not want to go to Donaldsonville. It's about 40 miles from Baton Rouge, 50 miles from New Orleans, and it was right on the Mississippi River. And in this particular school, they had 726 children. 80% of them were Black kids, and 20% of them were white kids. White principal, Black assistant principal, 35 white teachers, four Black teachers, and boy, nobody was getting along. Because whenever kids are not doing well, it boils down sometimes to race and class. And so my associate dean's wife thought I could walk that thin chalk line between the teachers. Because I've been teaching white teachers for the last 30 years. So I could go in there and talk. So it was really funny. Since I'm from Georgia, I had a town meeting and I wanted everybody to tell me what color they were. And because when I went down there, the Black parents assumed I was going to be white because I was coming from LSU. And they were all giggling. So I said, why are you giggling? They said, we thought you were going to be white. I said, I am. I'm just pretending to be Black. And so they all started laughing. I said, illiteracy is odorless and colorless. So if your child is coming to school and your child is chronologically five and developmentally two, that's a problem. So teachers are not at the hospital. You are. So who controls your TV? You should. And so the Black parents were telling me teachers didn't like them because they were Black. The white parents were telling me the teachers didn't like them because they were poor. Now I said, listen, I cannot change what color you are, and I can't give you no money. I said, but in 1929, in this great nation, we had the Great Depression. America didn't fold up and die because we are poor people. So why are we talking about things we cannot change? Now, what I can do, I can help you help your child to read. And so that's what my job is. So that's why we had a town meeting. So I told them, I said, if we were going down to the Superdome, we wouldn't have any problems. And so if when I said, so we need to value academics to the same level we value athletics. And so I said, that's what I need to work on. And so that's how we got started. So I visited with all of them at the Ministry Alliance come together. I had them to preach from, because South Louisiana is heavily Catholic. I had them preach from their pulpits about the importance of literacy. I talked to all of the hairdressers, barbershop people. I went to the local grocery store and had them to have a sign where parents could sign up. I just blanketed the whole community.
I was going to say,
And I
how
said,
did you do that? That's, I mean, how was that? Like, how did you actually get to do that? Like,
well, what I did, I wanted to know every community has movers and shakers, and ministers are movers and shakers. And so, what I argued with them about was I said, we came up with 52 scriptures, and I said, I want you to preach from your pulpits about the importance of literacy because you're not going to have Sunday school teachers, you're not going to have lectors, you're not going to have people doing the business of the church. And Father Holdingen told me he had seen a sharp decline in catechism classes because the people were having difficulty reading. So he told me he was going to tell the parents if they didn't come to my book reading program, he was not going to confirm their children.
I love
Yeah,
it.
so I had a bunch of parents come in then, and then I found out there was a bar owner that was calling the Times-Picayune out of New Orleans, and he was calling the state paper out of Baton Rouge. And I went down there. I said, Ray, let me say this to you. Teachers and parents don't do well in the afternoon when you got the news media and you're saying that these kids are failing because of white teachers. I mean, that's not a good something to have. So what I need you to do is to recruit these parents who will not come to school, but they will go to the bar. And so I started talking to him about how important literacy was in the bar, because if people didn't know fractions, because I found out that they calculate how many drinks you can get from one bottle of alcohol. So
Oh,
it would impact his business. And so he told the parents if they did, oh, on Wednesday, on Wednesdays, they had like a talent show. So I had some 16-year-olds dress me up and I went down there and I was talking to them. And then I was like, oh, are you having a good time? And they go, oh yeah, oh yeah. So then I started playing some music like Hotel, Motel, Holiday Inn. So they were all dancing as if they went. So all of a sudden I started talking about literacy. And it's like, oh my goodness, they froze. So Ray tells the parents, if you don't come to that book reading program, I am not going to serve you any drinks in my bar. So, and some of you have long tabs. And this is funny. Somebody told me that Louisiana was the only state that he knew of that you could bring saints and sinners together around literacy.
That's great.
So, by the way, I only had $500 to run this program. That's
Oh,
it.
wow.
Nobody's going to give you millions of dollars. And so I was kind of making it up as I went along. So I would say that was probably, and it sort of took me back to when I was a little girl across the street from my house, and that I ended up, teaching my friends how to read. And so you know how people talk about it, when you write a children's book, it comes from your life. And I think working on that book reading thing sort of came from my life. And of course, when everything gets to working, everybody gets excited about it. And David Moranis, who was the regional person for the Washington Post, wrote about that project on the front page of the Washington Post. And that's how I got connected with First Lady Barbara Bush and Dan Rather, because he came and did a story on that program. So everybody wanted to come, state superintendent, all kinds of people. And so I was able to get a lot of money then. So Ms. Schaaf became the principal of the year. And so I told him, I said, now, isn't this interesting? We started here with people talking and carrying on. And I said, at the end of the school year, we still have 35 white teachers, four black teachers, white principal, black assistant principal, but we have different perceptions. Oh, by the way, I hired two black parents, one negative, one positive, and two white parents, one positive, one negative. And I told them, if you're going to talk, go in the community and talk about what we're doing at the school.
That was smart.
And
That was
then
really
I
smart.
got permission to give them $50 per week for doing that. And then our congressman was Claude Holloway. I said, don't deduct their money. So they really got excited about that.
Wow, that's so smart to think about the different layers, the different in a community, who's going to talk, who's going to help, who's going to hinder, who's going to support. Oh, wow.
And then I had a bus driver who, because that's a rural community, so they didn't have any taxi people to pick people up. And so I got the school board to, and let me say, this is really funny. The school board was made up of 12 white men, and they always want to get two women to fix it. They do. They want to get everybody to fix it. So Miss Matthews and Miss Shaw had worked together, and so I made sure that teachers' salaries, when somebody asks you what you want, I made sure that I said, well, first of all, I don't want teachers spending their money on materials. And so it's just amazing how money appears. And then the local bookstore person got rich because I said, I want every child in the school to get their six favorite books. Boom, the money comes in.
That's great. That's amazing. Wow. That's amazing that it started with 500 and then it just grew into this movement. Wow. Were you surprised? Were you surprised that it took on that life?
Yes and no, because it's easy, it's like people jump on a bandwagon when they see things are working. And of course, all these important people were coming to Ruston. I mean, excuse me, to Donaldsonville. They met Dan Rather, they went crazy. Okay. And so the congresspeople, I mean, and that made them important in that particular community. And then, we started getting all this recognition and all of that. And so I said, okay, I'm going to make sure Ms. Shaw gets Principal of the Year. The teachers get their money. My person say, ask. I say, I'm going to be Santa Claus. Just ask. And they can say yes, no, maybe. And I got Walmart, I think it was Kmart and some of the local grocery stores to give like gift certificates. And so I would give the parents like each week they got like a gift certificate. Well, they like that. So it's like everybody wants to jump on board.
Wow, that's amazing. That's so
I had the
amazing.
coach from LSU to come at the time. He said I wanted him to, he brought the two top black boys and the two top white boys. And of course, people love athletics. It's amazing. 1,000 people show up on a Saturday because they're going to get a book. So I told the coach to say one sentence. You cannot be on my team if you can't read.
That's great. And that had a huge impact, I bet.
I mean, it's almost like the Taylor Swift, Travis Kelce thing. Everybody
Yeah.
jumps like, I can't do, because they see these people on TV, and so it's just amazing when they see them in person.
Wow. How about some insights from so what were some big takeaways from that work? Just that what was an insight that you maybe really gained from that piece, or maybe it reaffirmed some of your own thinking, but what was an insight you feel like?
Well, for one thing, after I did that program in Louisiana, I got invited to the University of Illinois to the Center for the Study of Reading. And at that time, going to the study of reading was extreme, well, it was extremely important. And as a result of that, one of my responsibilities was to go work with Chicago Public Schools. So I went in because that's where their grant was connected. And also, I went to Springfield, Illinois, and then Children's Press, that later became Grolier, that later became Scholastic, because they published my program, Parents as Partners in Reading. And that program was sort of a framework for Even Start, where we were working with parents and children at the same time. And, it's just that it's amazing. And I think that it helped me end up becoming president of the International Reading Association because you have to do something, and people all over the world sort of knew about it because no matter where you went, people kind of knew that was your focus. And so whenever I would go places, I would talk about that work, and then I ended up taking a group of teachers to China in 2009 for us to look at literacy there. And I took a group of teachers to South Africa, and then that was through People to People. That was a program that was started by President Dwight Eisenhower. And then I took a group to Russia. Now that was interesting.
Why?
Now let
Tell
me
me.
tell you something. Well, let me say this to you. When you go to places like China, I used to always, I told the American teachers, and some Canadians went with me to South Africa, don't talk ne negatively about America because you don't work for the U.S. Department of Education. You're in an international setting and you only know about your one particular school. So don't talk in generalities because these people don't know where you're coming from. Now, when we're in China, you would think everybody is perfect. They don't talk about, I can't believe 1.4 billion people are completely literate. And so you didn't hear any bad news. And I know we have a lot of Chinese students that come here to Michigan State. Well, it sort of reminds me of people who are Rhodes Scholars. I mean, we send our best and brightest, but everybody in America is not a Rhodes Scholar. And so when we were talking to their teachers and to their administrators, it was like it was like this perfectness. It was the same thing in Russia. No
Wow.
discipline problems, no nothing. We were supposed to go to Egypt, and when they had that turbulence, went to Russia. So it was quite interesting.
That's fascinating. Wow. That's just amazing. So, how about what did you feel like you enjoyed the most in your work?
Well, when I was the president of the International Reading Association, I enjoyed going to 49 out of the 50 states, and I'm going to go to Alaska this summer, but I'm going on a cruise. But I enjoyed interfacing with teachers. No matter where you go, there are teachers and there are students, and so that was a big highlight for me, is getting to interface with teachers. I mean, because I've been to Washington State to their state reading associations. And so just going and talking to teachers, and then of course going internationally. Like we used to have the last World Congress we had was in New Zealand in 2010. We'll probably never have one again because IRA just didn't have the money they used to have. But when we went there, the first time I went was with Carmelita Williams, and we ended up going to Australia, and we were in Sydney and
Wow.
Brisbane, and then we were in, once we went to a part of the world, we just like stayed there. We were going, I was tired as all could be. It was like doing a tour. So from there we went to Hong Kong, and
Wow.
then the Philippines, Taiwan, China, Malaysia, because all those places are very close, Japan, down in Thailand. But I had been to Thailand because Michigan State had an overseas master's program for teachers who taught in American international schools. So we had one in France and one in Thailand. And I went to Thailand about 12 times. But these were
Wow.
American international teachers. So I really enjoyed that because you find no matter where you go, the issues might be different, but people are thinking about the same kinds of things. And also, I enjoyed just getting to know different ways of doing. But I can tell you this one thing: during the period in this country, when the whole language movement was in motion, some places couldn't do that work the way we did it here. And I remember we had gotten a World Bank grant when we went to Africa, and to show them how to write their own books because they didn't have book sets. So we had them write their own folk tales or whatever, and
Nice.
then their kids could read those books.
Wow, that's amazing. So, how about anything surprise you about the work?
I would say that, I would say this one thing. You know how sometimes people do research for research's sake? I feel like the research that I did had an impact on people. It was not just something you put in the Reading Research Quarterly or the Reading Teacher, but it was something that made people think differently about what they were doing. And so to me, in a way, it became sort of a movement. And like First Lady Barbara Bush was the first, most people read about Eleanor Roosevelt or some first lady or Lady Bird or something, but her focus on family literacy, I think, had a big impact because most people wouldn't think that there are people in this country who can't read. And I remember Jonathan Coulter wrote a book called Illiterate American or The Night is Dark and I'm a Long Way from Home. And so I think it really focused in on something that was a movement. And I think, like right now, I would say that if people do research, back when I was in graduate school at University of Wisconsin, it was like focused on teaching, research, and service. I think now the focus would be teaching, research, service, policy making, and then also grant writing. Because if you do research and it doesn't change any policy, I mean, nobody reads it. And of course, being president of IRA, we had a lobbyist. So I learned how to talk to politicians about literacy.
Yeah,
Like
how
here in
was that?
Michigan now,
Yeah, how did you,
well, a
what
lot
are,
of,
yeah.
you mean like, well, our lobbyist was Richard Long. And so I would we learned how to talk to people on the House Select Committee on Education because these
Wow.
people are making decisions about what we do, and none of them have ever taught school for the most part. So you go in with 2 pages. Now, if they like what you're saying, they'll let you stay 15 minutes. And if they really like what you're saying, you kind of like I kind of studied the politician. I talked to people like Jeff Sessions and Yakima, you walk in because like they don't know who you're gonna be until you get there. And it's like, okay. And so they come in, they kind of stun. And so you soften it up by saying, look, I live in Michigan, but I'm a Georgia girl. So I know a lot about Alabama. And then you talk about Alabama football. Oh my goodness, Roll Tide. So you can start talking. So you have to have the kind of personality that can go in because a lot of the politicians have their own frozen memories of how they were taught to read and write, which is completely out of date. So you
Yeah.
got to learn how to study your client, ask them some critical questions. A lot of politicians will say, look at all the money we spend in education, and we have not seen that much progress. And so since I live in the state of Michigan, I always tell them, well, if a person had a lemon for a car, you'd be all irate and you would send the car back. I said, we can't send children back. And I said, when a child comes to school in August, parents are sending us their best child in August, not Christmas time. So we have to rethink. Children are not lemons and crushed berries or whatever. And I said, that's when you would get into talking to them about early literacy initiatives. Because I remember that President Johnson did Head Start, but Head Start is not Montessori. So then you get them in these deep conversations because a lot of people on their staffs, these are young people and they are trying to do politics, but they don't know anything about education.
Yeah.
So you kind of like reel them in to figure out how they were taught. And then you say to them, every last one of you, whether you or a doctor, lawyer, whatever, you have to have a first grade teacher or a kindergarten teacher. So teachers are important. And so you began to say, in this country, we don't have a utilized way of teaching anything. We don't. Everybody kind of does what they want to do. And in fact, I just wrote a book for Harvard Education Press. Where is that book? It's here it is. It's and I'm going to be talking at the conference, AERA, about it.
Oh,
It's called
good.
Teaching with Literacy Programs, Equitable Instruction for All.
I love it.
And so it just came out in October. It was from a Gene Shaw grant that I got.
Oh, nice.
Gene Shaw did Learning to Read, The Great Debate, and we're still debating it. I think what it is, we don't teach programs, we teach children. So I think this is a very good book because I work with on it with three of my former graduate students. Kristen White, who's at Northern Michigan, talked about medicalized language, how we put language in books. And then Laura Hopkins, who now lives in Madrid, Spain, she talked about fidelity. And then Anne talked about small group instruction. So we sort of take on this whole notion of fidelity because everybody says you should teach with fidelity. And Dick and Jane didn't have nothing to do with my life. And
Right.
so, there's a whole lot of different things we should think about. So I kind of did that. So I really think I miss the International Reading Association because it was a way to the world is very small. And so, global education and looking at how we think about reading and writing and listening and speaking and just valuing the importance of teachers is extremely important.
I love that thinking, and I, the moral work of teaching reading equitably to Black children, one of the articles. I love that article. Can you speak a little bit about the big thinking around that article in terms of how do schools, how do teachers, how do we prepare schools to teach reading equitably to Black children? I know that's a
Well,
giant
going,
question, but
it's a really big question. But Lima, when I first came here, okay, I'm gonna give you a little history. When I came here to work at Michigan State, Judith Lanier was my dean, and we were talking about tomorrow's teachers, tomorrow's schools, and everything. And like I said, when I was at Louisiana Tech, I basically taught all white teachers. We have this internship program here at Michigan State, and in my class fall semester, I had 19 young white females, one black female, and one Asian woman from Somalia. That's it. Rest of my students were all white. And so, one of the ways that I draw teachers in, so when I came here, they wanted me to do the Parents as Partners program. I said, well, you can buy it, but I need to do some different kind of research. So, when I went out to this professional development school, that school was founded in 1952, and the teachers were still teaching the same way they were, but they didn't have the same audience. So I wrote a book for Heinemann entitled A Path to Follow, Learning to Listen to Parents. And I used the met and this has worked well. I work with the medical metaphor that when a parent takes a child to the doctor collects information. They do sort of a deep dive into your family history. And if you ever go up to the hospital, one of my colleagues, her husband was over the residency program. So I asked if I could come up to the local hospital and see what they do. So you might have two senior doctors talking to four residents. Well, in a school, you have teachers who've been teaching for 30 years and teachers who've been teaching less than a year. So why can't we have these conversations? So, this whole notion is teaching a profession. Is it a science or what is it? Well, if it's a profession, if it's a science and all of those things, you collect data. So doctors collect family histories, lawyers collect depositions. Architects collect a lot of information about our lifestyles, but very few teachers have a history of a child's literacy development from the parent's point of view. We always say that the parent is their child's first teacher. Well, then you need to ask them those pieces of information. And I got tired of people saying when teachers don't live in the communities in which they teach, that's why children were failing. Well, we don't say when doctors don't live in the communities in which they practice, that's where their patients are dying.
Right.
So I think that book, A Path to Follow, and getting a sort of a literacy history, and I sort of did it the way you would do a deposition. And so children come in school early, they come in emergent, and they come in fluent. And so if the parents weren't telling the truth, I would say, you know what? If your cholesterol is 236 and you tell the doctor you haven't had any fried foods or milk products, they know you're not telling the truth. So now, if you were doing X, X, and X, then I would see X, X, and X, and then they would self-correct. Because I
That's
told
true.
them, look, if you go into the doctor and he says, have you eaten in the last 12 hours and you're about to go into surgery, and you say you haven't and you have, you're going down the table. So I say it's very important that you tell us the truth. And so that's how we started those conversations. Because if you think about it, doctors do treatment based on what you say. And so if I don't know you, then I need to have those conversations. And that's how I've been able to work with my young white teachers because they will say, "I will. I can't say that because I'm white." And I would say, "You just wipe yourself out. So what are you supposed to do?" I said, if people had to connect doctors and patients based on race, some people wouldn't have a doctor. So, if that same parent went and talked to a pediatrician, she wouldn't say to the pediatrician, "I can't talk to you because you're white." So you're a teacher. So I've never seen anybody go to a spa and say, "You know what? I really want to get old." So we live in a youth-centered society. But I have found that young white females in particular don't like conflict. I said, well, teaching is conflictual. You need to know how to have the conversation. So I think all of that gets into how a person can figure out how to teach other people's children. That's what Lisa says. I know Lisa pretty well. Lisa, and so that's one way that schools can begin to ask for information, because I don't know how you can teach if you don't have data.
I think that's fascinating. And the in your in your in that article, you say fostering equitable opportunities for Black children to become successful readers is more than a technical or ideological work. And so I love that there's not a specific formula, right? It's specific and individual to the students right in front of you, right? You can't put a blanket principles of what it might look like or sound like. You have to be responsive to the students in front of you and
That's
communities and
exactly right.
understand.
That's exactly right. And I tell my students that all Black people don't think alike, okay? If you know what I mean. So you just can't put people in one group. Because I tell people, I know white people in all 50 states and they don't have the same ideologies and they don't think the same way. Let me tell you something really interesting. I went to South Dakota Spearfish. And of course, I'm talking to all white teachers. And, they have a large Navajo population out there. And so they were having problems with the tribal kids. And they said that they, a lot of the people, and by the way, I've been to Washington State too. I've been down to Yakima, because that
Oh,
was what I
nice.
Kellogg. I've been to the Whoops Project,
Oh, nice.
Richland. Yeah, I've been down to Spokane, because that was what we did when we were Kellogg fellas. And it was really interesting. So sometimes you have to know how to have those tough conversations. And let me say this to you, as a Black person growing up in the Deep South, I had to understand whiteness, W.E.B. Du Bois, double consciousness. But I find that a lot of my white colleagues, they have not had the opportunity to talk to people who are different from them, and they can ask questions that people might perceive as bad, as a bad question, and get information. I'm going to read you what one of my students who works at, well, she's an intern at one of the schools. Let me see if I can find it. Let me see here. Her name is Madison. Okay. This is what Madison wrote me. She said, "Dear Dr. Edwards, I hope you are having a great semester after having you last semester and seeing your ways of teaching and knowledge. I wanted to reach out and ask you a question about a teaching decision." See, I like this. Right now, my fifth graders just finished writing their civil rights research papers. They did great on them. However, as I was grading them, I came across a question as I was editing. I noticed that some of my students were using the phrase colored people, which I know is outdated and should be said people of color. I was going through the papers and fixing the wording as a suggestion while grading them. Would it be morally wrong of me as a white teacher to correct my students of color's wording if they use the outdated phrase? The decision does not affect their grade for any student in any way, but I just wanted to know. I wrote her back. I said, "Hi, Madison. Good morning. It's wonderful to hear from you. My semester is going well. I hope yours is too. I completely agree with your point about the term colored people being outdated. It's essential to consider the historical context when encountering such terminology. If your students are working on a historical paper, it's worth noting that at one point, Black people were indeed referred to as colored people. However, it's crucial to emphasize that language evolves, and today the more appropriate terms are African Americans or Black Americans, reminding your students that this shift in terminology will help ensure that they use respectful and up-to-date language in their work. Inform your students that as a young white woman, you sought perspective from Dr. Patricia Edwards, an African American and university distinguished professor at Michigan State on this matter. It's essential to convey that your viewpoint is not solely based on your identity as a young white woman. Now, see, having those kind of conversations, she could go back and say, and a lot of times when people ask race kind of questions, people get all huffed up, but then they should be able to have a conversation. And she went back and she told me the conversation went extremely well and so forth and so on.
What a thoughtful response for you. I mean, I just admire your, I love that the relationship, you know, you have such a theme of relationship building in your work, in your outreach, and also with your students. I think that's beautiful the way that she felt comfortable to share that with you, and just the thoughtfulness in the way that you responded to her, I think is so noteworthy. So I love that.
That's the way I try to work with all of them. I said, no question is a bad question, because you're supposed to be in a teaching role, not in a combative role. And if, you know, if somebody asks a question, then, you know, it depends on their experiences.
Yeah.
You know, and what they've had. And a lot of people, you know, they tip around things. And so they haven't had an opportunity to have those conversations. So like, this is really funny. One student some years ago said, this boy, you know, said something about, are you really a teacher? Because he was as tall as she was. So she told him, she said, yes, I am a teacher. And she said, I told her, you whisper in his ear and you tell him he's 12 and not neat. And that if he doesn't do better, you're going to cut him up. So she told him.
What happened?
She said, you see, wait, she said, you see my green eyes? And he's like, oh. I said, he's 12. I said, so she told him that I'm going to cut you up. And
so, that's funny. That's so funny.
And she said, nobody's going to believe you because I said it. And so he's like, okay, I'm sorry.
You're so funny. I love that. So I'm trying to think a little bit more about, do you have suggestions for teachers, for policymakers, administrators, especially with what's happening in the world and in the field right now? Do you have any advice, or what do you see?
Well, I think, like, I'm on Governor Gretchen Whitmer's pre-K-12 literacy commission, where this is an opportunity to talk to politicians. I think that if you think about it, teachers are on the bottom level. You have all of these people above them making decisions, critical decisions, without sometimes the teacher's voice. And I think it's important when you're going to start making policy, because we had the third great reading law, we got voted down, because I think politicians think, okay, we're going to create this law, but they don't realize the implementation. Like in Michigan, we have 83 counties, and not all counties are the same. And so I think that politicians should include the voices of teachers and administrators in the conversations, especially if they're going to be making decisions that's going to impact what's happening in the classroom. Now, Michigan happens to be a collective bargaining state. So, you know, teachers do have a voice. Whereas when I lived in Louisiana, they did not have a union. And I don't think Georgia had a union. And so I do think we don't want to squeeze teachers out where you have nobody teaching. And in some communities, when you don't treat teachers right, they just move and go someplace else. And schools cannot, this is whenever I'm talking, I always say schools cannot and would not exist without children, and they would not exist without teachers. You know, we might have some machine up in front of the class trying to teach, but we need that human element. And I think we need to also give teachers the opportunity to create a caring environment. And like, you know, like our teacher education program has been ranked number one in the nation for the last almost 30 years. And so in my class in the fall, I had interns in Okemos. That's where all the professors' children live. So they're teaching a group on a group of kids. And then Lansing, you have more diversity and they have the same education, but I said you have to have a different framework for how you think about people. So if they go to Okemos, they're going to see children that look like them. And I'm bragging a little bit, but most of the students that I teach, they have been marinated in the literature. They come to school soaking and dripping with print. So for them, it's kind of difficult for them to understand that not all children come to school that way.
Oh,
I
that's
tell them it's the
fabulous.
same doctor-patient thing. Some people come in and they have good health, and some people come in and they have bad health. So the
Yeah.
doctor has to change what they're going to do. So as a teacher, you don't just read something from a book. You have to look at the case, do some reflective teaching, in order to, I say you have to be a reflective practitioner.
I love that. How about any other surprises in your work? I know I've kind of circling back to that. Any other surprises?
I would
But most fewer.
say, well, I would say that you probably saw the article I wrote with Bryant
Oh,
Jensen.
yes.
That was
Beautiful.
interesting
Yeah.
because, he's coming from a complete re religious background because he's Mormon. And you saw the examples that I wrote. I do think that even though we might not be able to teach religion in a classroom, I do think that I just finished, and I'll forward that to you, a blog where we're having, we have 100 samples from the AERA theme that I worked with ILA on, with them asking teachers throughout the country to collect writing samples of their students. I do think in classrooms, we have to create an environment where students can learn in a classroom. And so I would think that's circling back to when I was in elementary school, we started with a Bible verse. You can't do that now, but I do think you can start with some positive messages to bring students together where you create that learning community, because we have too many kids that are being bullied, and people say things that really have negative impacts on children. And so I would say that that's going to be extremely important. And I do think, just as I had a town meeting when I lived, when I was working with the parents in Donaldsonville, I don't think that people can hide issues of race in class when they come into a classroom. And I think you feel a little bit more comfortable if you come in and you say, look, I'm here to learn some things about you. These are some things about me, and loosen teachers up where they are not afraid to teach. Because I
Oh,
tell my
yeah.
students, nobody's going to tell me that I'm black. And I said, so you should, when people's, I said, you have to learn how to take the floor. Are we talking about what color I am, or are we talking about your child? But see, I told them, you have to learn how to maneuver the conversation. Because, like, when I walk in my class, I tell my students, no question is stupid. If you don't know the answer, we can have a conversation around it. Nobody in this class, you can disagree, but you will not be mean-spirited. You will not call anybody stupid. I'm not having it. You're going to learn how to disagree without being disagreeable.
I love that. I love that.
Because, and I think that's important where students don't feel as if they can't ask you anything. Well, they're in a learning position and they should be able to, voice their opinion and ask questions.
Right, that's right. Okay, so given your career to strive to transform thinking, which you have, what's your current advice to the field? What could you share with us?
Well, I think that, let me see. I would say the latest book I wrote with three very bright graduate students is the book that I think is a template for changing the ways in which we do things, and looking at literacy, not so much on what approach. Because remember back in the day, people would say, I'm a whole language teacher or I'm this kind of teacher. But using the student as the unit of analysis and trying to figure out the best way, it's almost like a football coach. You look at a tape and you say, okay, we got punched last week. So what do we need to do to improve it? And so coaches do that a lot. It's like, okay, we got beat. And so what we're gonna do, we're gonna focus here, focus there. I think teachers need to do that. I think sometimes teachers get so relaxed where people start talking about, I don't make this much money, I don't do this, and I don't do that. And they rationalize why things can't happen. And the general public is gonna talk about you. And so teaching is public and people talk about everything you do, and everybody went to school at some point, and they might have opinions. And I do think that teachers in schools, and that's what I encourage, need to go to the community and inform them, because if you don't, they're gonna make up their own stories.
That's so
And
true.
so you need to invite them in, and you need to invite positive and negative people in. And that's kind of what I did with the bar owner versus the Ministry Alliance. And you give them a voice because these are the taxpayers and they have incorrect information. Because my daddy was a barber, that was his part-time job. And he was talking about teachers one time. And I said, Daddy, you were sending us to school to be a teacher. You can't say that. That's not true. Because you know what it is, if when people don't know the story, they make up their own story. And so I do think with the diversity in our country, because to be honest with you, growing up in Georgia, there was no diversity when I grew up. Now Georgia has a large Latino population, a large Asian population, and that's just not what I grew up with. In my community, there were only black people and white people. That was it. So I do think that people need to get to know your client. And I feel other professionals learn how to do that. You can't run a business unless you understand client development. You will, I tell you, I always laugh and say two doctors that would go out of business immediately, and that would be pediatricians and gynecologists. Be mean, you lose your business.
That's true.
I mean, if somebody says, oh no, don't go to that person, it's rude, then you're not gonna have any clients. And the same thing with lawyers. And I tell, so my whole thing would be for if you're gonna be in teaching and you never know where life is gonna take you, you need to be Michael Fullan talks about change. If you don't change, everything around you will change. And so you change is something that we all have to go through. And so if you are willing to change and willing to do things and do in different kinds of ways, that would serve you a lot better.
Oh, Dr. Edwards, my cheeks hurt from smiling so much. This has been such a wonderful conversation. You're one of the smartest people I've ever talked with, and I am just honored to talk with you. And it's, you really are wonderful, and thank you for sharing your knowledge with me and with our guests and our listeners. And thank you so much. And
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. Oh, and let me tell you something else too. I like to tell jokes. I always tell jokes. And one of the couple of my master's students, they used to tell me jokes. They teach second and third grade. And sometimes you just need to laugh. So this one little girl told me a joke. She goes, when you throw a clock up in the air, what does that mean?
What?
Time's up. Time's up. She was so
It.
proud of herself. And then she goes, why was the orange suspicious about going out with this certain group of friends? I said, I don't know. He was afraid he might get peeled.
That's
I know.
fantastic.
And
Well,
then she
that's.
told me this other cute one. She said, why did the skeleton decide not to go out on for the school dance? I said, I don't know. He had nobody to go with.
Oh, I love that. I love that. Well, thank you so much. And we can't wait to talk with you more. So thanks again.